Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Narcissism Dakota. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Mazzella. Today's episode offers something a little bit different. I'll be discussing a recent paper I presented at a conference on adolescent depression. The title of my paper was Navigating the Depths of Depression Among Teens. This episode provides an edited down version of that presentation. I did my best to edit out the technical psychoanalytic concepts, but inevitably I needed to include some of them. I hope, however, despite using a little bit of psychoanalytic jargon, that I do a good enough job explaining what these concepts mean so it does not leave a non-psychoanalytically trained listener, perhaps like yourself, feeling confused. While I'm going to include the most important insights and key findings, I must admit the dynamic element provided by the audience's comments and questions will unfortunately be omitted as well. Perhaps I will discuss those questions and my responses in the next episode. If you find this topic interesting, mark your calendars. I say that joking, but I have another presentation upcoming. And that one is going to be specifically on narcissism. And I'm extending my warmest invitation to all of you. If you're interested in learning more about the upcoming presentation and having the opportunity to join me for a live discussion, don't hesitate to reach out and email me. I'll send you the details about that, such as the date and the time, etc. Okay, on to this sort of edited, modified version of my presentation. Adolescent depression represents a critical mental health issue. The prevalence of depression has been steadily increasing over the past decade. Studies have indicated that the rise is particularly notable among certain groups, particularly adolescents and young adults. Depression ranks among the primary mental health issues confronting adolescents, affecting an estimated 10 to 15% of teenagers during their adolescent years. And I recently learned that high school girls considering suicide soared to 50%. This concerning trend underscores the urgent need for a comprehensive understanding of adolescent depression and, in my opinion, effective treatment interventions that are designed to address the cluster of symptoms that characterize this syndrome, the syndrome being depression. In this presentation, I aim to review a selection of theoretical literature on depression. I'll endeavor to integrate various theoretical frameworks illustrating through clinical examples how theory can be effectively applied to facilitate change while also maintaining a deep understanding of the patient's subjective experience. In other words, this is not just an intellectual endeavor. In healthy development, children gradually become aware of their parents' relationship, understanding that there's a connection between them. This realization can bring about the painful acknowledgement of feeling, and I quote, excluded from the parental bond. Recognizing this relationship, experiencing discomfort, mourning the loss of exclusive attention, are all fundamental to the development of mature psychological functioning. The child can accept this reality if they have already established firmly the good internal object. That's a quote, the good internal object, which is only possible if there's been more love than hate or more harmony as compared to family conflict and chaos, or if there's been quote unquote good enough maternal care. They can then tolerate being, again, the word excluded, which I'll come back to over the course of this presentation. It's an important piece of depression, but they could tolerate being excluded and separated from initially the primary caregiver and perhaps later the parental couple or its subsequent symbolic representations, which again, I'll say more about in a moment. In later life, these symbolic representations of exclusion, separateness, aloneness will not be experienced as catastrophic. Again, this is in healthy development. Also, the term depression has been used to describe reactions to experiences of deprivation and infancy as a vulnerability to feelings of loss and disappointment, intense need for contact and support, and feelings of abandonment and helplessness. In other words, these are all the factors that go into defining depression. Depression has also been defined in terms of superego development. The complex phenomena of guilt and self-directed aggression. An individual who is sad or who is mourning, which by the way is healthy, may feel diminished, but he does not feel I am bad and deserving of punishment. In depression, what is lost is a sense of one's own worth, which attests to the fact that the self-representation may be a significant part of the focus of treatment interventions. Again, I'll say more about this momentarily. Some analysts have emphasized that ambivalence was much greater in depression and that the depressed patient was unable to retain a relationship with the primary object. And by the way, this is consistent with what I mentioned a moment ago. Again, I quote, they have not established firmly that good internal object. It is also thought that there are two types of depression in adolescence. The first type is mainly pre-Oedipal and based on a symbiotic tie with the omnipotent, need-satisfying other and involves feelings of shame, humiliation, inferiority, inadequacy, narcissistic object relations, which just basically means relationships with need-gratifying heart objects. In other words, what can they do for me? And dependency. The second type of depression is considered more Oedipal in nature, with a great deal of guilt, self-reproach, and the punitive superego that I mentioned a moment ago. Here's a quote that a depressed adolescent patient sent me. I think it accurately captures the teenage experience. But what do you think? Tell me if you can imagine that this leads or causes depression. And I quote, certain that others are observing and thinking about them, teenagers develop an inflated opinion of their own importance, a feeling that they are special and unique. Many adolescents view themselves as reaching great heights of omnipotence and also sinking to unusual depths of despair, experiences that others cannot possibly understand. Transitioning from this quote, it becomes evident that these behaviors and perceptions align closely with, in psychoanalytic theory, which referred to as manic defenses. These defenses serve to alleviate the profound sense of loss and insecurity that adolescents experience during this developmental stage. And by the way, just as a side note, when I say manic, I'm not using the word manic in a clinically diagnostic way. What I'm referring to are a series of defenses that come together to protect the adolescent from ever experiencing these vulnerable emotions. Factors such as separation from parents, social isolation, the challenges of forming peer groups, and the fluidity of self-identity all contribute to this tumultuous period. Furthermore, the omnipotent thoughts and feelings often find reinforcement within the adolescent culture itself, which can glorify risky behaviors like substance abuse, partying, and aggression. This cultural context further validates and perpetuates the adolescent's inflated self-image and reinforces their belief in one, their uniqueness, or two, when they don't reach or they slip from this high of omnipotence, their deflated, worthless, and depressed state is reinforced. And again, I'll say more about this in a moment when I go into the clinical example. I hope I'm beginning to demonstrate that depression is a complex phenomena, and it seems to me that effective treatment must take into consideration all of these factors, all of these dynamics, along with the nature of internalized objects, which basically means what I said a moment ago, that's the established firmly, the good internal object, which is so important, but only possible, again, I'm just reviewing, but when there's that family harmony that I mentioned before, or when there's more love than hate. So we need to take all of this into consideration, plus the defenses, which is basically the coping mechanisms that they use to protect themselves from feeling vulnerable, and oneself and other representations. All of these factors coexist, contributing to the intricate landscape of adolescent depression. Recognizing the coexistence of all of these factors, plus some other factors that I'll mention momentarily, is crucial as it underscores the importance of employing multiple conceptual frameworks to better understand and specific intervention techniques to address this very complicated mental health issue. Let's shift our focus now to a practical case, allowing us to delve into the lived experience of an adolescent struggling with depression. But very quick, a disclaimer alert. When presenting clinical material, in order to protect the anonymity of my practice and patients, I weave together a composite case, an amalgamation of diverse cases. However, this narrative represents an authentic story along with my actual interventions. This is the case of Mary, a young woman who began a 2-time-per-week treatment with me while she was in high school. She came to me after what one might call a severe depressive episode, which interfered with her day-to-day life, like studying, sleeping, and eating. She lost all interest in school and was barely functioning. From what I witnessed in the early days of treatment, there were intense feelings of worthlessness, guilt over not performing in school, loss of concentration, and quasi-suicidal thoughts like, I would never kill myself, but I don't really see the purpose of living. Parenthetically, slowly she revealed more active suicide thoughts, such as jumping out of the window of her 30th floor apartment. But at the same time, she reassured me that these were just thoughts, and that she had no intention to kill herself. It seemed at this time that medication mattered and was helpful. After about 1 year of treatment, she felt stable enough, and soon after she graduated from high school, she discontinued her use of these anti-depression medications. According to all reports, Mary was a diligent student. She devoted herself to her studies, had a few close friends, and refrained from drinking or substance abuse. At first glance, there were no apparent triggers for her depression, which, by the way, is not uncommon. We gradually uncovered that preceding her descent into deep depressive episodes often lay a rupture of some kind. While these episodes appear to arise spontaneously, seemingly without cause from her perspective, over time we identified a pattern linked to loss. The insights I'm about to share stem from her initial year of college. It's important to note that the dynamics I'm about to outline are not exclusive to late adolescence. They are commonly observed among many younger adolescents as well as young adults. Like many adolescents, Mary was navigating the complexities of social life and identity. Her journey into the world of sororities unravels as a powerful illustration, encapsulating the whirlwind of emotions ranging from initial euphoria and eager anticipation, and in psychoanalytic terms, this may be referred to as the image of the grandiose self merge with the omnipotent, all-giving other, the narcissistic, blissful union of self and other, in this case, the other, being the sorority. But that oscillated, or let me say shifted, quite quickly to a profound abyss of devastation, plunging her into the depths of crippling self-doubt and depression when confronted with the unexpected. And by the way, this is much like what I described in the earlier quote that I detailed, right? The high and then the crushing, devastating low. When Mary was rushing a sorority, basically that just means she was trying to join a sorority, she did not get an invitation, a bid, to her sororities of choice. What I'm about to describe is the lead up to her discovery of this heartbreaking and devastating realization of profound rejection. She reports that she was getting ready. She was texting her parents. She was so excited. She was so sure. I was going to get invited to pledge the sorority, she reported. This is the sorority that I want. This is amazing. I feel great. I have on my high heels, my skin-tight jeans. This is great. Then she opened the bid card, only to find herself overlooked by both of her choice sororities. This is stressful. This is the next 4 years of my life, she reported. This is my social life. It sucks. It hurts. My other friends are all getting into their sororities. I knew my life was over. She was crying. My friends didn't know what to say to me to make me feel better. I don't know what to do. I have to transfer to another school. This is the end of me ever having friends. This is the end of my social life. I'm stripped of all my friends. I have nothing. I don't want new friends. She spirals deeper and begins her self-reproach. Something is wrong with me. I'm not good enough. I'm not pretty enough. I'm weird. Do I not know how to hold a conversation? I feel horrible. She's crying. She can't talk. I tried to help her move from a dysregulated to a more regulated state, and she begins to express that the other sororities are so cool, and I'm such a loser. I'm so embarrassed. I was talking to my parents, beating myself up. I am thinking about my friends. They will all go to the coolest parties. I felt so shitty about myself. And people asking me, why wasn't I invited to X sorority? They must be saying, what's wrong with you? And I'm going to be excluded from the pregame sorority parties. And if I do go, I would be an outcast there. Under the weight of mounting depression and anxiety, she told me that she confided in her mother. In response, her mother urged her to focus on the positive, emphasizing that she was accepted to a sorority. Her mother questioned why she always seemed to dwell on the negative. Reassuringly, Mary reported, she was told by her mother that everything would be all right. Okay. So let's try to conceptualize what's happening with Mary. While there's a wealth of insights to extract from this brief vignette, my focus will be on what I deem central to understanding depression. The narrative underscores the depth of her emotional response, marked by tears and a struggle to articulate her feelings. The inability of her friends to provide solace hints at a profound sense of isolation and emotional anguish that eludes verbal expression. Now, you may be saying to yourself, Mary was able to acknowledge and verbalize feelings of humiliation. Why am I saying that she couldn't do that? It's important to note that while Mary was talking, that she was unable to employ these words in a manner that grants her a sense of detachment from her emotional experience. In other words, these expressions are lacking the transformative power that the symbolic function of thinking often carries. I'll delve deeper into this aspect shortly, but for now, it's crucial to recognize that Mary, initially at least, lacks the capacity to symbolically represent her inner emotional state. In psychoanalytic terms, we can see this example of what I alluded to a moment ago, the pre-Oedipal type of depression. We see a narcissistic merger fantasy of the grandiose self with the ideal other being the sorority. However, it's important to note that there's another way to look at this. The heightened anticipation and excitement that she experienced can also be described as a manifestation of splitting. The initial anticipation and positive emotions are evident as she prepares for sorority bid day. She expresses confidence and excitement about the prospect of joining the sorority she desires. Her looks, tight jeans, and optimistic outlook, everything is great, ideal, perfect. So just as sort of a pro-level tip, when you hear something like this, you should already be suspect. In other words, this is a problem or a potential problem. A potential problem is looming. And as can be anticipated, this quickly changes to devastation. Mary becomes completely overwhelmed by the emotional impact of not receiving an invitation. And I'll just say parenthetically, for those of you who may like an alternative conceptualization of the same material, we can also say there's an intense affective arousal than a lack of emotional attunement. This is something I spoke about in an earlier episode. In other words, there's a mismatch. No smiling mother, no smiling caregiver, followed by an extreme narcissistic injury as defined as a shame state. Shame states play a significant role in depression. Okay, let me go back to splitting and how everything quickly turned to all bad. So you could see everything was all good, great, perfect, and now it's all bad. And in that, in there lies the nature of a split. The realization that she's been overlooked by both of her sororities of choice left her feeling rejected and worthless. Importantly, this was not an isolated incident. At this stage in her psychotherapy treatment with me, we had already addressed similar experiences characterized by the same intrapsychic dynamic reaction. This seamlessly transitions to another noteworthy element in the conceptualization of depression, self-reproach, and the emergence of a negative self-representation. Mary begins to engage in self-reproach, questioning her worth and attractiveness. She wonders and quickly concludes, and again, as a side note, when someone quickly concludes something without questioning it, that's our job to help them begin to develop a more questioning state of mind, the development of a capacity for thinking, for symbolization. But I'll hold off there and I'll say more about that in a moment. She quickly concludes that she's not good enough, pretty enough, or capable of holding a conversation. This negative self-perception contributes to her emotional distress. In the theory of melancholia, the superego is portrayed as a powerful force that can turn against the ego with violence. This is akin to Mary's experience, where she engages in self-reproach, judging her worth and attractiveness. The punitive aspect of the superego, evident in the theory, aligns with Mary's negative self-perception, contributing significantly to her emotional distress. For instance, Mary spoke about not being invited to her sorority of choice, which means people must be saying, "What's wrong with you?" See, in her mind, they are judging her. She says, "I will be excluded from the pre-game sorority parties." This echoes Mary's struggle, as she not only attacks her worth, but anticipates being judged by others. Is this not a projection of her judging and critical superego? In other words, projection being what? That she puts this on people around her. It's coming from them, not from her. And then it oscillates. Then it comes from her. And then it comes from the environment. The fear of judgment becomes a source of shame and intensifies her depression. Moreover, as I listened closely to Mary's account, I noticed that she, in fact, is quite judging. She judges the sorority into which she was accepted. These are not the popular or cool girls. In other words, these are the girls who are the losers. But why, you may ask, does she judge herself in such a harsh way? This is a complicated question, but in part, if the environment has failed her, in this case, the bid from the popular idealized sororities, this unconsciously triggers prior and much earlier failures. Let me just quickly remind you of something I mentioned earlier. If there is this good internal object, they can tolerate being excluded. And we see here that Mary could not tolerate being excluded. She cannot tolerate the separation. We can speculate that Mary's catastrophic breakdown, when she feels and thinks that she has failed to achieve the bond with another, again, we could speculate at this moment that this harks back to the earliest period when such a condition is not simply uncomfortable, but threatens life itself because the developing child doesn't have a capacity to make sense out of something like this. In other words, there's a good possibility that there is some unsettled trauma dating back to Mary's childhood. Now, in my original presentation of this material, I spent a good deal of time detailing the earlier childhood trauma. However, in the service of moving this episode forward, I want to jump to treatment interventions. Mary found herself overwhelmed, a torrent of emotions flooding her. When confronted with such heightened states, my initial priority is to guide individuals from a dysregulated condition to a regulated one. In Mary's case, my approach involved deliberately slowing down the pace. While some may find this repetitive, my intention was to foster a space for a questioning conversation. This method aligns with the influence of prominent psychoanalysts such as Bion and my late supervisor and good friend Richie Lasky, emphasizing the importance of an inquiring presence over definitive interpretations. In other words, I'm not telling anybody how they feel, how they should behave, or why they felt a certain way. Try to help them get to the point where they can recognize why they felt and had such a reaction. The essence is to encourage individuals like Mary to participate in a thoughtful dialogue. My technical approach places emphasis on, I quote, verbal thinking, and it recognizes that Mary, amid her tumultuous emotions, is engaging in thoughts. It's crucial to understand that she's in a state of hyperarousal, a shame state, and at the moment her ego is flooded and needs some assistance. Perhaps one can call this an ego-supportive approach. To facilitate this exploration, the focus is on helping Mary activate her own reflective capacity so she can think about the unfolding events. Initially, the interventions are designed to accept the legitimacy of her disappointment, inquire about her sense of specialness, attractiveness, and popularity, and what it feels like to be at center stage when she imagined herself to be in the most popular sorority or at the best parties. What do you imagine? Who will see that? How will they respond? How will you feel? These are all acts of, again, in my field, what we call containment and appreciating the subjectively useful component of Mary's experience. The aim, this is the ultimate goal, is to transform undigested facts. In other words, these are raw emotions, right, into cohesive verbal thoughts. And with that, we unravel the intricate layers of her internal world. In my experience, this represents a pivotal focal point. As you may remember from my earlier statement, and here I'll quote myself, recognizing this relationship, experiencing discomfort, mourning the loss of exclusive attention, are all fundamental to the development of mature psychological functioning. If our aim is to promote mature psychological functioning, we aid Mary in addressing negative emotions, including feelings of being excluded, invalidated, as well as sensations of separation and loss. I want to put emphasis on this because these are not the negative emotions that I presented earlier. I am worthless, not pretty enough, I can't hold a conversation. No, what I'm describing now are more genuine emotions. That's what we're working on. They're more painful and up to this point went unnoticed and therefore unprocessed. One may even say that they were masked, covered up by those other emotions that were simply designed to inflict pain. Those were all those critical comments that I just mentioned. I hope that makes sense. So in other words, what we start getting to are a more authentic set of emotions that involve a deep sense of loss and separation. And this is evident in her experiences of rejection, right? Which now we can understand in a more complete way rather than her just attacking herself. See, when she's just attacking herself, there's no forward movement. But as we begin to explore feelings around separation and loss, now we're in a much better position to help her process these feelings and accept loss. And of course, loss, as I mentioned very early on, is a big part of depression. Okay, I think we have to begin wrapping it up at this point. But I want to say, in the original presentation, I went on to talk about aggression and the punitive superego, also known as the inner critical voice, and how that impacts depression. I finished the presentation by addressing dating and the strategies that are utilized by those experiencing narcissistic depression as a means of self-protection. If you're interested in hearing more about the link between aggression and depression, or the dating experience of someone who's overcoming depression, please be sure to let me know. Also, I would be curious to know what you thought about the use of psychoanalytic concepts. I don't typically do this on the podcast, and I'm wondering, was that helpful or distracting? As always, feel free to shoot me an email. All right, until next time, bye for now. Disclaimer alert. The Narcissism Dakota podcast is provided for general information purposes only. The content presented in this podcast is not intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any psychological condition related to narcissism. The content on this podcast should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. For specific advice pertaining to narcissism or any other psychological condition, you could reach me directly. I am an experienced mental health practitioner who is always taking on new patients. If you would just like a consultation, I can do that too.